Our angelic speaker for the evening is Jacqueline Kramer. She has spoken here at least twice before. She is the author of Buddha Mom and 10 Spiritual Practices for Busy Parents. Her latest passion, and she is a passionate woman, is bhikkhunis. And bhikkhunis, of course, in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, of which she has been a practitioner for
30 years.
So she knows something about the subject, and we welcome her once again to Many Rivers. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Rob. And it is a pleasure always to be here. Hi, Gregory.
Hi.
It's always a pleasure to be here. This is a really different kind of a talk for me to give because this one has lots of facts and stuff. So I have my sheet that I'm going to work from this time. I became aware of the bhikkhuni, what's going on with bhikkhunis became of interest to me when I was in Thailand last year. And I met a lot of bhikkhunis and bhikkhunis, and they enlightened me as to what was happening. And as Rob said, I'm a very passionate person, and so I usually get into these projects either through anger or love. And my passion for bhikkhunis came out of anger about some of the things I saw, and it's turning into love. So, but it started out as anger, but in Thailand. So what I'd like to share with you tonight is a little bit about a little bit about the history of the bhikkhunis, and then go into a little bit about what's happening in Asia and what's happening in the West with bhikkhunis. My focus is Theravadan bhikkhunis, and I'll just touch lightly on the bhikkhunis. And the difference is that in the Mahayana tradition, they're called bhikkhunis, female monks. And female monks are called bhikkhunis in the Theravada tradition. So, the Buddha meant from the very beginning, even before he started teaching, he meant for there to be a fourfold assembly, which are female and male monks, female and male lay people. In the Pali Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he said, "I will not pass away, O evil one, until I have bhikkhu disciples, bhikkhuni disciples, laymen disciples, lay women disciples who are accomplished, disciplined, skilled, learned, expert in the Dhamma, practiced in accord with the Dhamma, who have learned from their own teacher, make it clear, who are able to refute in accord with the Dhamma, other teachings that appear, and then teach the wonderful Dhamma." So the story usually that we hear, that usually goes, that he reluctantly allowed women to join the Sangha when the woman who raised him, Gotami, begged him three times herself and twice through Ananda, and through much resistance. But in the scriptures, he says from the start that in order for his teachings to be carried on, they need a fourfold assembly. So to me, that says that there's some discrepancy in the teachings. And of course, it's very hard to know what were the Buddha's words and what were the later writers, and nobody's able to really unravel that. But to me, this is like the statement that absolutely authenticates that there are supposed to be female monastics, and that this was an important part of the Buddha's plan. So bhikkhunis and bhikkhus were ordained, and they went on with their sanghas, and in the 3rd century BC. Sanghamitta, the daughter of King Ashoka, the big, the king who really spread Buddhism throughout Asia, was called by her brother to Sri Lanka to ordain female. The princess wanted to be ordained, and so he called his sister, and she came to Sri Lanka and ordained, and that's where the female lineage in Sri Lanka started, is from that source. And then in 433 AD, the same lineage was taken to China by Ayasara. So there is an unbroken lineage that went from India to Sri Lanka to China. And that's very important, you'll see, as this story unfolds. And that was in the 5th century that she took the lineage to China. The Theravadin bhikkhuni orders died out in the 11th century because there was a lot of warfare, and a Hindu warrior came and overtook Sri Lanka, and that was the end of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka. And then the same thing happened in Burma and Thailand. The bhikkhuni order died off and remained that way until the first international grand ordination held in Southern California in 1988. Now, that's a long span of time. There was no Theravadin bhikkhuni lineage. I mean, except for the Chinese lineage, which some dispute is that Theravadin or not, but there is a direct link. But in Thailand and in Burma and in Sri Lanka, the Theravadin countries, there were no bhikkhunis. And they came to get very comfortable with that. The monks did not mind not sharing their rice bowls, some of the monks. And they got to the place where they did not recognize women as being able to have a monastic calling. So in 1988 in Southern California, there was an ordination, and that was through the Chinese lineage. This is also what I'm speaking about is the Theravadin. And Ayakima, Ayadharmapali, and a Burmese bhikkhuni were all ordained in that ceremony. And 20 Sri Lankan anagarikas were also ordained. When they went back to Sri Lanka, they were not recognized, that their ordination was not recognized, and so it didn't grow from there. It dissipated. So this ordination was considered not a success. But Ayakima went on to teach, and you probably all have heard of Ayakima. And then Ayadharmapali was in the West, and she wasn't getting enough support, so she relinquished her ordination. There's two ways in the Vinaya that is allowable to restart a bhikkhuni lineage or to become ordained as a bhikkhuni. Obviously, before the females were ordained, there were only male monks, and so the bhikkhus could ordain the females into the lineage. And this allowance was never rescinded. So in the scriptures, there is the allowance that bhikkhus can ordain bhikkhunis. And the other way is the twofold, the bhikkhuni, the dual ordination with bhikkhunis and with bhikkhus together. So there's all kinds of legalistic, how many angels are dancing on the tip of the pin related to this in the actual practice. There are a number of fundamentalist monks who have a lot of power, and so this has been a difficulty. In 1996, in Sarnath, India, 10 Sri Lankan women were ordained by Sri Lankan monks and the Korean monks and nuns who had that Chinese lineage that I was talking about. So they had both. And they went back to Sri Lanka and were respected by the lay people and by many monks. However, the powers that be, the government, still did not recognize bhikkhunis and the more fundamentalist of the monks. This also happened in Thailand with the Venerable Dhammananda, who's going to be giving a talk in Spirit Rock in May. So this was followed by grand international ordination in Bulgaria in 1998. And which was ordination was conferred upon women from many different countries. It was held under the auspices of Taiwanese-based Fo Guan Shan organization. And so this ordination combined once again the Chinese unbroken lineage from the Theravadin and Sri Lankan monks, and monks in Theravadin monks, not just Sri Lankan. So that kind of it's pretty amazing if you think about it. You know, the time we were just, Jim and I were just talking about the time we're living in now. It's just an amazing time for Buddhism. And if you think that since the 13th century there's been no bhikkhunis, and now it's starting to rise up out of the earth, it's pretty amazing. There are over 500 Theravadin bhikkhunis today in Sri Lanka, which is pretty rapid growth if you're considering it started in 1998. That's pretty rapid growth. And they're backed by a large number of the bhikkhus and lay disciples. There's still no official recognition of the bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka. Bhikkhunis continue to be unrecognized in Burma and Thailand. In those countries, it's even dangerous to wear the robes. There are some brave women who are doing that, but
why is it dangerous?
Because there's some hostility about what they're doing. They feel it's illegal. It's illegal. And there's a threat to the order of things.
So is this the government threat, or is it more general populace?
I think the general populace has grown up with the teaching that the bhikkhuni order died out in 500 BC, 500 AD, and there isn't possible to be a bhikkhuni order again because there's no bhikkhunis to ordain. That's what people are taught in school in Thailand. So they have the expectation that there are not going to be any female monks. But there is also hostility from the more fundamentalists, like all fundamentalists in any religion. You know, you get that kind of fringe element. That's not the general populace.
Just a note is that in Burma, Thailand, and Sri Lanka, Buddhism is the state church. So the and the head of the order, the male monastics, there's a sense of undermining their power within the state apparatus if they allow for a change, you know, like in the structure. So I just wanted to point out that element.
That's right. You're threatening the powers that be if you become a bhikkhuni. If you go, and what the women in Thailand, the few brave women in Thailand, don't they go to Sri Lanka where they can get ordained, they come back and they're not recognized. And in fact, in Burma, a woman went to Sri Lanka and became ordained and came back and they put her under arrest. So it's a dangerous thing in many, many ways right now to be a bhikkhuni. But there are 700 Sri Lanka is the best place for it right now, and there are 700 about there, even though they're not officially recognized. And in Thailand, it's my friend just came back from Thailand this last month, and it's getting better. There's about 20 bhikkhunis there at this point, and there's so much going on there. Other things going on there that they're probably not focusing on it. But I have a friend who's a bhikkhuni in Thailand who has been shot at and threatened, and so I've seen the seedy side of it, the fear that these women live under. But it's changing, and that's the party line of... and it is changing, and I think that it is good to put a positive spin on it in that now there's 20, and if it's anything like what happened in Sri Lanka, it will grow quickly. There are many 8 precept nuns, they're called machis in Thailand, but they're subservient, they have no status at all. It's not like they're there to serve the monks. So you'll go to Thailand, you'll see, and you'll think, well, what's she talking about? There's nuns all over the place here. But it's not bhikkhunis. See, bhikkhunis is, there's an equality of stature and respect. And it is very clear in the Buddha's time and beyond that women could become enlightened as well as men. You didn't have to get into a male birth. That is like one of the myths that's perpetrated. But because in the Buddha's time, there were many bhikkhunis becoming enlightened. And that's all you need is one to make it, you know, a myth. And there were many, many enlightened women, monastics, and laywomen, yeah, too. So, so that's what's happening in the international community in Asia with Theravadin. Now, in Taiwan and Korea, there's many thousands of bhikkhunis. They're very, very well respected. I have a number of friends who went to Korea to become monastics. I met a lot of the Korean and Taiwanese monastics when I was over in Thailand too. And there's such a different quality because they're so respected in their countries, and so they have that confidence of the same confidence that the men have of being fully who they are. It's really a beautiful thing to see. So a lot of women, even Theravadin women, will go to Korea or Taiwan to ordain. So now in the West, I changed a paper here. Oh, okay. In the West, there are a good number of Theravadin monks, about 300 bhikkhu monasteries in the United States. There's not one bhikkhuni monastery in the United States at this point. My dear, dear friend, Aya Tathaloka, bhikkhuni Tathaloka, she's a Western woman who is, I guess she's in her 40s, and she's been ordained for 20 years, so she started very early. She became ordained in Korea, and she returned after 5 years to the United States, and she was the only bhikkhuni in the United States at that time. I don't have the date on that, but that was, I don't know, what would that make it if she's been ordained 15 years ago. Ayakima had died, and so she wasn't around anymore. And our Dharmapali, who I mentioned had been ordained in that first ordination, had left because she couldn't, there was no support for her. So at that time, Ayatata Aloka was the only bhikkhuni. And now there's about 20 bhikkhunis. So that's basically the general lay of the land. And you can learn more about it. Feel free to take these and go on this site, and there is literature about, extensive literature by Bhikkhu Bodhi and others, other scholars about this issue. I'm not a scholar, and I'm not touching this on a scholarly way, but you can get that if you're interested in it on that website, papers on this. But that's the general lay of the land from history to the present. So the questions that I asked of my bhikkhuni friends and that had been sitting with me, why should we support bhikkhunis in the West? Is it an anachronistic thing to be a bhikkhuni with all the rules and the way you have to it's very complex getting them food, and it has to be before 12, and when they travel they can't carry money with them. There are many, many rules that they need to follow. And so I asked my friend, and she gave me some ideas about this, which I'll share with you. The women's movement in the West demands that there be equality in religions, and it's coming into Buddhism as well. And there cannot be, the Buddha said this, and it's absolutely, to my mind, makes a lot of sense. There, a land, he said, does not truly have a true Buddhist order until female monastics, male monastics, lay women, laymen are all present. And that is his definition of it. It doesn't take hold in a land. So we're very new here. And we've got many, many, many lay women and lay men who are teachers. And we have bhikkhus. We have male monks. But we're very remiss on the side of female monks at this point. Whether in Asia or here, when we see both female monks and male monks living at that level of renunciation, it's an inspiration to all of us. Like we were talking about, Jim, it's an inspiration to see somebody who has dedicated their life so completely to the Buddha's teachings. And it is different being a monastic than being a lay person. And it is, you know, like Jim and I were talking about how now we have access to, it used to be that you had to go to a monk to get the pith of the teachings, to go to get the Abhidhamma, and you had to go to the monasteries. And that's not so true anymore. It's much more available to everybody. But in order to see somebody who is so dedicated and living the life to the point that is what their life is about, we still need monks and nuns, monks and bhikkhunis for that purpose. And in Asian countries, it's a matter of, as a feminist, it's a matter of lifting up all of Asian culture for there to be bhikkhunis. In Thailand, poor young boys have the option to go into the monastery. The only thing the girls can do is go into the sex trade because that option isn't available to them. So it has a very erosive effect on the population of women in Asia to not see women in a position of power like this. And that is one of the reasons why I think it's really important to support Asian monasts, Asian bhikkhunis, is because when you support Asian bhikkhunis, you're supporting women in Asia, basically, on a broader level, because it is their national religion. And so to see women equal to men in that way lifts the entire female population. In the West, we don't have that same issue. And so I said, you know, to my friend Aya, Tata Loka, why would a woman choose to be a bhikkhuni given that there's no support? And basically, it comes down to something very, very simple. And it's the same thing as why would a man choose to be a bhikkhu? It's a calling of the heart. And you know if you're called to do it. And that's something, it's like if you're called to play piano or if you're called to play soccer or anything. It's a strong feeling, and this is the monastics I've spoken with. It's a strong feeling from the heart that this is where you belong. And as a Buddhist, I feel like if somebody has that calling, I do not have that calling, but if somebody does, I really want to support them in being able to do that. And I have a lot of respect. And I am learning so much from my friend who is a bhikkhuni. She's been for 20 years. I've been at it for 30 years, but she's at a whole nother level than me because her level of commitment is at a different level than mine. And I am learning so much from her. And I come to you in the middle of this process. I'll have a lot more to say about it as time goes on because it's only been a year that I've been interested in this issue. And I had Aya over. She was over at my house last weekend. And for the first time, I fed her the way that you do. And there was something so beautiful and ancient and humble about her sitting with her bowl and you put everything in there and she takes whatever's given. That what I saw, that is very different than any way that I have ever embodied the teachings. And it taught me a lot. Just that moment of putting the different foods in the bowl for her and her standing there so mindful, holding her bowl and choiceless. It was pretty profound. So she said, and this is about the rules. I mean, to me, it's like I am so rebellious, and a lot of Americans are. I mean, we're really don't tell me what to do, you know, that kind of mentality. And so, you know, to me, to have to do this and that and would be like, I'm not at that level yet. But she said, we understand the rules when rightly held are like the grasses of a basket woven together. They offer a container and support for the monastic life. The monastic vessel or vehicle of practice and liberation. We understand the difficult situations to be the most worthy causes because there is the most need. As an act of self-charity or self-training, working with adversity has the merit of making us strong, wise, and skillful. Thus, difficulty in and of itself is not necessarily to be avoided and may even be looked for as it may have merit. So, there are two bhikkhunis in our back. There's 20 bhikkhunis in the whole United States. We have two of them in Northern California. Sister Subijata and Aya Tathaloka. Yes?
What about the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Talmadge?
That is Mahayanan.
Okay. It's just not in that religion.
Right.
They definitely have women monks there.
Right.
They come into town in their robes and their shaved heads.
Right. That's Mahayanan.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're
talking about Theravada.
Talking about Theravada.
Okay. Tonight, yes. Yes. Okay. So there's only 20 in the United States. And we have two of them right here in our own backyard. And so that's pretty exciting. Plus, and this is very exciting, they have been given the gift of some land on the Sonoma coast to have the first female bhikkhuni forest hermitage in the United States. Right here. And I hope that you'll have Aya Tathaloka to come speak here, because she is so eloquent. And you know, there's something about her presence. She did the 3-year retreat, as the Tibetans do. She's been like so doing it, so it's so deeply in her cells. Just being with her is really a treat. So I hope she'll come and speak here at some point. So if you feel like, and I hope you do, make me very happy. If you feel like a calling to support these women, they are really in need of support on many levels. They need health insurance. They have no health insurance. They need, you know, living things. They are. She has an attitude. It will come, and it does. But if you feel called to support this really seed of a movement, it's just a seed right now, very exciting to be part of it, feel free to take brochures. The Alliance for Bhikkhunis is a nonprofit, and they just funnel the money. You could say, I want it for this, and it'll just come through them to the bhikkhunis. Or whatever project, if you wanted to go to Thailand there's projects in Thailand that are being supported. Today I'm speaking mostly about the American, because I think it's like, because we're so close to it, it's right here. And they are in need of our support. And so, and then the other way is, I have, and I'll put this out. Where did I put it? Oh, here it is. Dharma Dharini is the nonprofit that houses the bhikkhunis who are in Fremont, and who the two bhikkhunis that I told you about, and who were gifted the land. So if you want to go directly to them, this is how to contact them. So you could just write it on a pamphlet or something like that, because they don't even have anything at all at this point, no flyers, no anything. I find it very exciting, frankly, to be at the beginning of this movement that is going to take off. But in order for it to take off, we have to support it during this very awkward kind of stage where are we going to keep from Asia, and what are we going to let go of, and how to make it American? It's very exciting, very exciting. So I'll just take any questions or anything anybody wants to talk about.
So what? How do you see the issue of what monastics in general in the West, in the United States in particular, should take from Asia or not take from Asia?
What do I see personally?
Mm-hmm. What do you hear the bhikkhunis here say?
Yeah, okay. It's a very delicate issue. My friend Susan wrote a letter, and one of the very progressive monks said, really knocked on her for, like, you just don't go about willy-nilly changing things. All of the orders, including Theravada, and especially Theravadin, are, like, really, to change anything is a big deal, okay? So, and I see the purpose of that, because people could just change things willy-nilly, and then what is it? It's just this watered-down thing. So that's kind of the purpose of it. So I could tell you my personal, but when I address this with the bhikkhuni, with Aya, she's very careful about what she says, and so we're learning to be careful, because I'm one of the people who represents it. And careful is not my middle name. but I don't have anything solid in me about it should be this way or it should be that way or this should change. I feel like any kind of lower than male things need to be looked at. I think that it's very, very hard in this culture for them not to be able to carry money when they travel. That means whenever they travel, they have to have a lay person with them, which is very expensive. So we may have to look at that. And yet there's something very beautiful about that they don't carry money, you know, that they can, like, just trust the universe and to get them where they're going. But, you know, we're not an educated culture of how to support that. So,
just on that point, I'm sure some of the Mahayana traditions must have ways that monastics have dealt with some of the issues, like money, mm-hmm. carrying money and traveling. Do you know about any of that, and what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not really well educated about the Mahayana traditions. However, when I was in Thailand, both the Korean and the Taiwanese bhikkhunis, there was a layperson with them, okay. And I suspect they dealt with all the finances. But I don't know if in the Mahayana tradition they can't carry money. You might know better.
Yeah. In the Mahayana ordination lineages, the ordination lineages in China and Korea, the non-Theravada ones, mm-hmm. are not Mahayana ordination lineages. Mm-hmm. They are Dharmaguptaka.
Yes, and, that's the direct lineage.
Yeah, and Mula Sarvastivadin.
Right.
And Sarvastivadin. Mm-hmm. But all of those are non-Mahayana lineages.
Right.
So I just want to clarify.
Yes.
That. And the rule about money applies, you know, like
to the Mahayana,
yeah,
as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because all monastic ordination lineages are non-Mahayana. I was a monk for 6 years. For people who are not aware of that, and one of the things that you mentioned about lay people, like not supporting that nun, and so she returned. The most difficult thing for me when I was a monk was that lay people didn't understand what being a Buddhist monk meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just sort of responding to both the stories you've told, and it's my opinion that in order for the monastic sangha to take root in the West successfully, Buddhist lay people mm-hmm. also need to be
educated
mm-hmm. about that, you mm-hmm. know. And my feeling is that a lot of Buddhist lay people in the West don't see value
That's why I asked that question. Yes, that's why it's a pivotal question.
Right. And I'll try and cut this short, but that's true not just of Buddhism, but for example, in Catholicism, most Catholic lay people don't understand why anyone would bother being a Trappist, you know, like or a Carthusian. You know, it's like, you know, what's that about? And so, I mean, one of the principal reasons I returned to lay life was just that constant weird, you know, expectation of what a monk was on the part of lay people. You know, like, so there needs to be a concerted effort simultaneously. You know, I'm not sure exactly what form that
this
would
form.
Take. This form.
This form.
You know, of
that's what that's what this is about.
You know, having being the designated person to drive the monastic and handle the money and all like that. It's actually a wonderful teaching.
It's amazing.
It's I love the story you told about serving the food. It's a wonderful to be in that relationship of generosity of someone else.
And to see somebody so open to whatever the universe brings. And you can't know that unless you're with a monastic. And that's the thing, is people have not been with monastics. And if they have, they haven't been with female monastics unless they're very, very fortunate, like, you know. And it is different. The female energy is very different. And you need that, too. But there is... But, see, that's what I'm feeling. This was going to be a PowerPoint presentation, but I found out you had to pay like $350 to rent a PowerPoint, and the Alliance hasn't bought one yet, so that's why I'm doing it this way. It's more fun to look at the pictures and stuff, but I said, okay, you know, we can't get one in time. I'll just wing it. But Alliance for Bhikkhunis is lay women going out to educate the lay public about monastics. However, you really can't know the energy of a monastic until you're with one, and how it is so different than the energy of a lay teacher. And so I hope, you know, we could talk about Ayut Tathagatoka coming here maybe, because she's there's a level of surrender that is palpable. But that is, and so I'm, like I said, you're getting me fresh. This is my very, very first one of these talks, you know, and I'm educating myself as I go. And it's not so much the history, I think, that, I mean, I need to have my history down, but also the major thing is to be able to relate to people why we need monastics, why we need to support monastics in the United States, why it's not just some kind of anachronistic system, why it's still part of Buddhism, because we have been so inundated with simply lay teachers. And that's very important, too. And that's one of the, you know, it's like how Ayut described it. It's like, you know, to hold up a table, you need four legs. You need lay teachers and lay people who are Buddhist. You need male and female. You know, and I'm a female lay teacher. We need female and male monastics. So you need all four. And we're out of balance at this point. And I'm coming to see that. But I'm not quite yet at the place where I can... It's coming into my consciousness, but I'm not quite at the place where I can describe it very simply. So that's why I'm using so many different words, because I want to get across that, yeah, this is something really, if you're interested in Buddhism coming to America and supporting it, this is an important piece of that.
I have two questions. The first one's relatively easy, I think. I've seen Ajahn Bhan's
Braun from Australia.
Yeah, uh-huh. I've seen his presentations on YouTube. They're very, very fascinating.
Yeah,
wonderful guy.
He's great.
He talks about nuns with his group in Australia.
Yes, yes, there are.
So what do you know about them?
That's a very lively group. That is, I think, in the whole West, him and Achan Sujata, who's with Achan Brahm, very supportive. He's very supportive of female monastics. And there are more, they're part of the monastery. So that's a very, very good place for female monastics.
Have your monastics that you know in the United States been in contact with them?
Oh, everybody. I don't know if you know this about monks and nuns, but they all, they're wired up with each other. Do you know that, Jim, about that?
Yeah.
They're like, everybody knows everybody, and Aya Tata Aloko knows every single bhikkhuni in the world, probably. Theravadan bhikkhuni. Yeah, so yeah, they're very much, it's a very lively, and Achan Brahm is work, and Achan Sujato, who is part of that Australian group, are working on getting the Thais to recognize bhikkhunis.
Yeah.
So they're
doing. They came from Thailand and.
Yes, they're.
Well,
they come from the Thai forest tradition, and I think Achan Cha, was a tradition they come from, and so they're bringing the men along. I'm so impressed with these men. Yeah.
The other question I had was interesting. We were doing tabling at the Wednesday night market in Santa Rosa for the PZI, the Pacific Zen. And a guy comes up, and we had a Buddha on the table. And a guy comes up, and he, I think he's from Cambodia, but it might have been Thailand, I'm not sure which. But he pulls out his little medallion, the Buddha medallion. It says, this was my father's, and this kept him from getting killed in the war.
Huh.
And they're very, very superstitious in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the superstitiousness of Catholics are in that way, you know, in terms of medallion protection, St. Christopher medals and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
As well as he saw a yellow-robed monk, one of the Cambodian guys,
mm-hmm.
that's in this area, walking down the Wednesday night market. And he turned to us and he said, he shouldn't be there because he's bumping into women in the Monday night, in the Wednesday night market because it was crowded.
Right.
He could bump into women.
Right.
So to me, that's like, that to me is the dark side of Buddhism.
Sure, absolutely.
That the Asian countries haven't faced.
And that's going to be faced right here, because that won't fly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, so what have your bhikkhunis, you've talked, it's sort of this gentleman's question, but from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
Do they recognize the failures of Buddhism in those countries? And not in terms of changing the rules, but changing how it's taught so that you don't grow up these kind of what I would call failures of Buddhism, for people to be that bizarre.
Yeah. Well, superstition is in every single culture.
Absolutely.
And so that is something,
it's a shared failure of all of them.
Yeah. The bhikkhunis do not promote any kind of superstition. It's reasonable. The Theravadan bhikkhunis are, and bhikkhus, you know, there's all levels of it. There's the fundamentalists, there's the really clear practitioners, you know. So, but this question of how to import Buddhism and not import its shadow is certainly one that's up. And I'm writing an article right now on Yashodhara, who was the Buddha's wife. And we need female role models of lay women who were enlightened. And she is an incredibly great role model for that. Mythical myth. So that's what's happening. It's like, it's a dance, and it's a very slow dance. You know? It's like, because things are going to have to be changed. Or they won't fly here. but it's going to have to be changed slowly. And so that is the tact that Achan Brahm, Achan Sujata, Ayatata Loka, all of the really reasonable and monastics are taking, that things are changing, but they're going to have to be very, there's going to be council, there's councils, they have councils, and they, so it's going to take some time. We have to be patient, and there is a lot of baggage that for me, you know, sets me off, and I have a lot of trouble with it. But thank God for Ayatata Aloka, who can deal with that stuff without getting pissed off, you know, and realize it's just not the truth of Buddhism.
Some of that baggage to me is how the monastics relate to the lay people.
Mm-hmm.
As if the lay people are just here to serve us, and we are the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
And lay people aren't the real Sangha.
Right, and
how much of that abuse come across?
That is not what you get from I don't know Achan Brahm very well, but...
No, you don't get it from him.
Yeah.
But you do get it from a whole lot of...
Well, but, you know, there's in any system, there's people who are going to take the power and puff themselves up with it. And they're not the... What is the Ira Mahasangha? That's not the Sangha of enlightened people, but there's always going to be people like that who take the opportunity to, oh, well, I'm a, you know, and that's kind of greed, hatred, and delusion kind of deal. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. not something you can legislate people to not do. They do it in every culture, and they do it in every religion, and it'd be great if you could develop a system that didn't have that abuse of power or putting yourself above somebody. It's not intrinsic. It's in the Oriental system, definitely. The higher, lower thing, boy, I really felt it when I went to Thailand to get an award for teaching Buddhism to mothers. And I'm a lay person, so there were all these other women getting awards, and a number of them were bhikkhunis and bhikkhunis. So they had us below the, you know, they
mean on the dais or something?
Huh?
Mean on the dais?
Yeah. And the bhikkhunis and bhikkhunis always went first, and I was going, huh, you know, but that's the Asian system. I don't think that's going to transplant well, that sort of and there are bhikkhunis and bhikkhunis and male monastics who are not into that stuff, and there are ones that are.
I find that much of what you're commenting on here is both interesting and disturbing observations on a belief that has as an absolute fundamental aspect to it compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And to not have compassion for anybody that wants to be on the path, I find that to be quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But not only that compassion isn't there, but it also tells me how hard this is to truly bring that compassion into your heart and have it for everybody. And to have all these other things of power, rigid rules, and the beliefs that you have in your mind overrule true compassion for somebody else who wants to be on the path.
It's phenomenal.
It's mm-hmm. just amazing. Yes,
it's phenomenal.
It is.
Yeah. I never cease to be amazed by what humans who've been meditating for long periods mm-hmm. of time are capable of doing, you know, teachers, and I mean, you know, it's astonishing. I don't understand it really, but it's human nature, and
it sure is. And it tells us this is not an easy thing that's being tried here.
No. Thank you. Yeah, I totally agree.
I was taken by the way you used the word commitment in describing. Did you say you had been on the path for 30 years and mm-hmm. this other person was 20 years, mm-hmm. but her commitment was way stronger? Mm-hmm. And I found myself thinking that our commitment is our essential teacher. And whatever it is that you're committed to, kind of, it gets transmitted. It's whatever it has to give us in the first place gets transmitted through the quality of the commitment.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
That we're. And I was wondering about do you notice a different quality of commitment among the women versus the men, or do you kind of?
Yeah, I do. It's harder to be a woman monastic than to be a male monastic. It takes a lot more grit. You know what I mean? It's like you're flying against the wind if you're a woman monastic. Whereas, especially in Asia, you know, you become a monastic, you become, you know, honored and fed, and you know what I mean? Not so for women. So women monastics have to have a lot of grit at this stage. And I also noticed that when I saw, because I had the privilege of seeing so many women monastics of all the traditions when I was in Thailand. And it's a different quality we bring to our spirituality. It's very service-oriented. There is the scholarship, and there is the deep meditation practice, but I noticed in the women there was a real quality of service that was I'm sure there are male monastics who have a quality of service, but I've never seen it, and it was on high abundance.
When I was in Korea, I saw a lot of bhikshunis, you know, there are more nuns in Korea than there are monks. And I asked my teacher since name about that. And he said most men become monks because they're lazy. and he put it at 80% become monks because they're lazy, because they'll get fed, and you know, like you do some ceremonies and funeral rites and that thing, and you'll be taken care of. Incidentally, he didn't put that down. You know,
yeah.
He considered that to be a very useful social function. You know, like he says, but to become a nun, you know, like first of all, if you became a monk in Korea and you changed your mind and wanted to go back home, your family would take you back, especially if you were the oldest son. But if you were a woman and you became a nun, then that was it. They're like, they didn't want you to come back. Like, if you changed your mind,
then you changed the locks.
and so he said the tendency was that when a woman became a nun in Korea, that she was really there, you know, like for the duration. You know, like that, you know, like she was committed to that life, and there was a sense of effervescence in the nuns' monastery. It's like visited that, you know, was palpable. You know, like,
yeah.
And the tendency for monks is to sort of try it out for 2 or 3 years, and then, I think I'll be a banker. But my teacher was very funny about it, about monks. You know, like. So I just thought I would share that.
Yeah,
story.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's great. You know, I went to, at Genjoji Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, there was a bell dedication ceremony I went to that all the big Roshis from all over came to. It was like it was Roshi land. There were Roshis everywhere. And it was the greatest thing because each one was so who they were, their personality was so vivid, and you know, the big slow one was really big and slow, and you know, the funny little bubbly one was, you know, it was the, and I saw that in the Korean bhikkhunis at the event I was at. They were so who they were. They were so in their skin. It was, you know, which is another reason to have role models like that. You know, for a woman to shave her hair, you know, that's another taking it to a whole nother level. And for me as a woman, to see a woman do that, it's like inspiring. It's on a very gut level, it's very inspiring. So, if you would like to become more involved, please do take brochures. If you have any questions, there's email addresses there too. And if you want to be in direct contact, they're moving right now, so I don't have a phone number for them. Dharma Dharini is moving. The donations are tax deductible, and so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.